Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia. He served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he has also had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you. Happy to join you.
And about 100,000 people have taken to the streets in Kiev and in the Ukraine, protesting their government's about face on a deal to join the EU because of pressure from Russia. What I find extraordinary, though, is that Vladimir Putin has charged that the EU is blackmailing Ukraine into the deal, whereas, of course, the Ukrainian protests are saying that they're being strong-armed by Russia. What do you make of that?
Well, I think Mr. Putin has it wrong. If you look at what the focus of this is that next week in Vilnius, the European Union is going to hold a summit meeting, and they had hoped to sign with Ukraine at that meeting an association agreement. The association agreement would, among other things, create or allow Ukraine to have a free trade arrangement with the European Union. However, the European Union has for a number of months been telling Ukraine that it has to meet certain criteria with regards to democracy within Ukraine in order to have the EU ready to sign that agreement. The pressure that the EU was applying was on Ukraine to do things to strengthen democratic standards. Had the European Union simply wanted to bring Ukraine in, they could have dropped their demands and just gone ahead and signed the agreement.
And among the requirements that the EU imposing is to free the former prime minister, right, Yulia Tymoshenko?
Right. Well, Tymoshenko, she was the opponent of Yanukovych in the 2010 election, and he barely won by about 2% in the final or second round. And she's now been in prison for 2 years. The European Union has not made her release a formal requirement. What the European Union has called for is an end to selective justice. But a number of EU member states have said that they would not support signing unless Tymoshenko was at least allowed to leave the country for medical treatment. And first and foremost among these countries was Germany.
And these demonstrations that are the biggest demonstrations since the Orange Revolution demonstrations, I believe a lot of them are also focused on her. And that leads one to this would you call it, paralysis or dichotomy between these two parties. The country seems to be fairly evenly divided between a kind of pro-European West and a pro-Russian East.
Well, first of all, you're correct. I mean, what you're seeing in Kyiv today was the largest demonstration since the Orange Revolution 9 years ago. And there weren't demonstrations just in Kyiv. There were reportedly 20 to 25,000 people demonstrating, for example, in the western city of Lviv. And there were smaller protests elsewhere in the country. But what you've seen, I think, in the last year or two is actually a growing swing on the part of the Ukrainian population looking towards the European Union and the Association Agreement. And polls in the last couple of months have showed 50 to as high as 58% of Ukrainians wanted the Association Agreement. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, in Ukraine, they look to the European Union, and they very much would like to be able to replicate the living standards in places like Germany or even Poland, for that matter. But I think also for a growing segment of the population, they would like to replicate in Ukraine the rule of law that prevails in the European Union. So this is something where, you know, before people might have seen more of a divide, and certainly there still are Ukrainians who would like to see Ukraine turn back towards Russia and the Russian-led customs union. But I think that group is increasingly in a minority.
And this Russian-led customs union already has Belarus and Kazakhstan. I think it's pretty fair to suggest that the EU would be, over a long term, would be a much more economically advantageous move than to be a part of a compact with countries like Belarus that are frozen in time.
No, that's exactly right. And I mean, if you just look at the size of the total economies. If you take Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus, you have gross domestic products that combined are maybe $2.5 trillion a year. If you're talking about the European Union, it's an economy that's six times larger, $16 trillion a year. So certainly there are economic advantages there. I think what has some in the Ukrainian government worried about is initially adjusting to that competition with the European Union is going to be painful. But certainly within a few years, that sort of competition is going to allow Ukrainian companies to operate more efficiently. And the long-term benefits are going to be potentially huge for the Ukrainian economy. And we saw this happen in the last 10 years when Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, the Baltic states joined the European Union. Initially, it was a bumpy period for a couple of years, but then those economies really took off when they were within the EU context.
Again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. So much of this feels to me like it's all about Putin and the way that he's turned back the clock in Russia, the way that he has ruled Russia. I mean, he's basically destroyed almost all vestiges of the free press, completely taken over the judiciary. He's using the worst kind of Russian prejudices against homosexuals to maintain his popularity. And he seems, in terms of his foreign policy, he doesn't really have a foreign policy. He seems incapable of advancing Russia, and his only obsession is to try and do everything he can to diminish the United States. Is that a fair reading? I know I'm being a little harsh here.
No, it's fairly broad. I mean, from the perspective of a lot of Ukrainians, the reason that they want to go to Europe is that they reject the sort of authoritarianism that they've seen returning to Russia. And although the Ukrainian decision when they announced on Thursday that they were suspending their preparations to sign the association agreement, that was certainly a victory for Mr. Putin in the sense that Mr. Putin, you know, desperately wants to see Ukraine join his customs union, and it's part of Russia's effort to reestablish influence in the post-Soviet space. But the interesting thing was, while Ukraine said it was pausing in its work with the European Union, it did not say it was turning back towards the customs union. And in fact, the Ukrainian prime minister on Friday specifically said Ukraine was not going to join the customs union. So right now, Ukraine seems to be more at the middle. Putin can take, I think, some satisfaction from the fact that Ukraine will not sign the association agreement on Thursday in Vilnius, but it does not mean that Ukraine is reversing course and coming back in the direction of Russia. So I think the victory that he scored was limited.
But the protesters, the BBC is quoting a lot of protesters saying that we want our children to have a future and not to be pressured by Russia. And my understanding is that the Ukraine depends upon imports of Russian gas, which of course cross through the Ukraine into Europe. And, you know, Gazprom, the monopoly in Russia, has complained that Ukraine has fallen behind in payments. And there was I think back in 2009, Russia cut off gas supplies to the Ukraine in a dispute over prices. And that, of course, caused fuel shortages across Europe in the middle of winter. So it's not exactly a leap of logic to figure out that that there is some possibility of a strong-arm tactic in terms of the gas spigot.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. And actually, I mean, we have seen pressure in the last 6 months by Russia. Some Ukrainian sources say that their exports to Russia are down about 25%. The Russians seem to target particular industries. So one large Ukrainian businessman who's very pro-European, all of a sudden that he's found that his chocolate exports to Russia have been stopped because suddenly the Russian Sanitary Commission has decided that they are unfit for Russian consumption. So the Russians have applied some very strong-arm tactics. The interesting thing, though, is that they appear to have backfired. I was in Ukraine in September, and virtually every Ukrainian I talked to said that the strong-arm tactics had made Ukraine more determined to move towards the European Union. Now, the gas question is an area where Ukraine has a huge vulnerability. It still imports probably around 50 to 60% of its natural gas consumption from Russia. However, for the time being, Russia still needs to transit a lot of gas through Ukraine to Europe in order to meet its contract requirements with Germany, Italy, Austria, and countries in Western Europe. And that gives Ukraine leverage. In 2006 and 2009, in both cases, when the Russians cut off the gas that was going to Ukraine, the Ukrainians simply took advantage of the gas that was being shipped through to Europe. They just used that gas. Now, Russia has been working hard now to build pipelines that go around Ukraine, but for the next several years, Ukraine still has some leverage in this regard, and the gas war for Russia is a tactic that may be a little bit difficult to play. Now, the Russians are trying to change that, but it'll still take them a few years before they can move huge amounts of gas to Europe without having to go through Ukraine.
So the current prime minister then, or president, Yanukovych, who narrowly beat Tymoshenko, who he subsequently jailed. He's obviously more pro-Russian, certainly, than she is. But you say he's somewhat sitting on the fence at the moment. What's the story, though, with what happened with the world heavyweight boxing champion, Vitaly Klitschko? He was supposed to join this rally, and apparently he's very popular in that country. And it looks like they figured a way for his plane not to land. So how sensitive is this government to this revival, if you will, of the Orange Movement?
No, I think this demonstration very much bothers Mr. Yanukovych. Remember, when these demonstrators came out in 9 years ago in the Orange Revolution, they were specifically demonstrating against him. They were demonstrating against the fact that he had stolen the election. And the results of that demonstration was a revote in which Viktor Yushchenko won. So I think there's a personal aspect that bothers him. And what you've seen on the part of the government is you've seen the standard tricks that they play. So Vitaly Klitschko, the boxer who heads the Udar Party, which is the second largest opposition party in the parliament, he was flying to Kyiv this morning to join the rally. And for various reasons, the Kyiv airports could not accept his flight, so he was diverted to another airport 300 miles away, which delayed his participation in the rally. And other things that you've seen is the state-owned television station and television stations owned by people who are close to the government simply aren't reporting on the fact that there's 100,000 people in the streets of Kyiv. Instead, they've been reporting on a smaller government-organized demonstration of maybe 1,000 people that is supporting the government's course. This is sort of very standard, though, in Ukrainian politics. I think it's frustrating to people, but if you look at what's going out on the internet and social media, Ukrainians can tap in and understand what's going on.
So to that extent, it's kind of a mirror of Russia, isn't it? Except that the Russian people seem to be I talk to Russians who basically say, we don't have politics anymore. You know, the younger generation have just given up because it's been – Putin has basically just taken it over. There is some activity, I understand, still on the internet and bubbling beneath the surface. But it sounds like in terms of democratic aspirations, the Ukrainians are – haven't given up like the Russians have.
I think that's a very fair statement. I mean, certainly democracy in Ukraine over the past 4 years since Viktor Yanukovych became president has been under greater and greater pressure. But you still have real politics. You have in Ukraine, in the Ukrainian parliament, an opposition party which controls about 190 to 200 of the 450 seats. So there's real back and forth going there. There's a real vibrant civil society that is pushing back against government efforts to limit freedom and democracy. And I think you have a much more organized opposition with much broader popular appeal than is the case in Russia. And so you do see huge differences. Certainly, I think Mr. Yanukovych aspires to have the same level of political control as President Putin has in Russia, but the Ukrainian population is not letting that happen. And that's a good thing for Ukraine.
So whatever happened to the politician that was poisoned remember, it was a hideous poisoning where his face broke out, and It was a very toxic substance. They poisoned with
Viktor Yushchenko, correct. Well, he was the one that in 2004, when they had the revote, Viktor Yushchenko was elected president over Viktor Yanukovych.
Right.
And Yushchenko appointed Timoshenko as his prime minister for probably 3.5 of the 5 years that he was president. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the two of them didn't get along.
Right.
There were huge personality conflicts. I think history is going to probably show that the blame rests more with Yushchenko than Timoshenko. And so they had this fantastic opportunity in 2005, huge good feelings from the general population. They had a majority in the Rada. There was, I think, a readiness on the part of the Ukrainian population. They were prepared to take hard measures to begin to get on the right track to real economic reform and to institutionalize democracy. And unfortunately, Mr. Yushchenko missed a lot of those opportunities. And so I think you then saw that in 2010, this reversal where the population elected Yanukovych, the loser of the Orange Revolution, they restored him to power in what people said was a free and fair election, which is to the credit of Yushchenko. But unfortunately, opportunities were missed that could have resulted in Yushchenko's reelection. I think it's provoked a certain amount of cynicism on the part of Ukrainians. They went out into the streets in 2004 in huge numbers. They were able to reverse the stealing of an election, and then nothing really happened. The interesting thing about today is that you're now beginning to see Ukrainians come back and go to the streets to protest their concerns in a way that you haven't seen in Ukraine in the last 5 or 6 years.
So, Stephen Pfeiffer, just in the last few minutes here, what is this Eastern Partnership summit that's going to take place in Vilnius, Lithuania on the 28th and 29th of November? The Ukraine, whether it reversed itself or not, but basically stalling on whether it's going to join. Who are these ex-Soviet states that are wanting to join the EU?
Yeah. Well, the European Union back in 2008, 2009 launched the Eastern Partnership, and it was targeted as a vehicle to engage Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus, and then three countries in the Southern Caucasus, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia. And what it looks like now is that Georgia and Moldova will initial association agreements. The hope had been that Ukraine would be able to sign its agreement, which is actually already completed and has been initialed. But it looks like that will not happen at this point. But the Eastern Partnership is really the institution. It's the mechanism that the European Union is using to organize how it engages with countries on its eastern flank in order to bring them closer. And what they use is this thing called an association agreement, which is a very detailed agreement. It includes a free trade arrangement, but it also includes lots of language that would basically bring a country's political and economic norms into sync with those of the European Union. The association agreement does not hold out the prospect of membership, but it would bring a country a long way to preparing for membership if a later political decision was taken to, in fact, bring that country into the European Union.
Well, Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Happy to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who is the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to the Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he has had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the new groundbreaking study that identifies 90 commercial and state-owned entities responsible for producing two-thirds of the man-made greenhouse gases causing global warming, half of which have been produced since 1986.